you've got to Judges chapter 7, that's on page 206, Judges chapter 7. The Midianite raiders have come, Gideon has blown his trumpets, an army has gathered to him, God has reassured him with a sign, and then Gideon here, Judges chapter 7 and verse 1. Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him, rose early and encamped beside the spring of Harod. And the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, 'Whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.' Then 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained. And the Lord said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will test them there for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' shall go with you. And anyone of whom I say to you, 'This one shall not go with you,' shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand. And let all the others go, every man to his home." So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Gideon was below him in the valley. That same night the Lord said to him, "Arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp." Then he went down with Purah his servant to the outposts of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. When Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade, and he said, "Behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat." And his comrade answered, "This is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp." As soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." And he divided the 300 men into three companies and put trumpets into the hands of all of them and empty jars with torches inside the jars. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout, 'For the Lord and for Gideon.'" So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp, the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. Then the 300 companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hand the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade and against all the army. And the army fled as far as Beth Shittah towards Zerarah, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabath. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. Well, we're going to stop there, but I just want to close by skipping to the end of the Gideon story. It was a great victory, defeat of the Midianites, but let's just skip to the end. Just turn over chapter 8 and verse 28. So just before the final paragraph, chapter 8 and verse 28. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more, and the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. Jerubbaal, that's Gideon, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father at Ophrah of the Abiezrites. As soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. And the people of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hand of all their enemies on every side. And they did not show steadfast love to the family of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in return for all the good that he had done to Israel. So you might want to leave the book of Judges open there at chapter 6 and 7. Would you rather be weak or strong? Surely that's a no-brainer. If you're weak, you're limited. You're vulnerable. Whereas if you're strong, you can do and achieve so much more. You can attract and impress others. Being weak is uncomfortable. We have to depend on other people. Being strong feels much better, much healthier. Whether it's physically, or financially, or socially, whether it's our abilities, or the size of our church, strong beats weak. Right? Unless God turns that thinking on its head. Earlier we read the story of Gideon. And what I want to do today is to show you where that story fits in the book of Judges and to draw out one particular lesson, which is vital for us to hear, a lesson about strength and weakness. Now we've already seen how the book of Judges fits into the unfolding story of the history of the Bible. Judges comes after the people of Israel have entered the promised land of Canaan, but before the people have a king to rule over them, before they have a monarchy. Indeed, the very last book, in the last verse in the book of Judges, captures the ethos of the whole book. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's how the book ends. The times of the judges were times of disorder and instability without a strong center. And the book of Judges divides into three parts. First, there's an introduction that sets the scene for the whole book. And the key verses in that introduction are in chapter 2. And these verses describe what we might call the cycle of the judges. Now, here's an extract from those verses that sums up the cycle. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, sin. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies. They sin, and God sells them, as it were, hands them over. And they were in terrible distress, sin, sold, suffering. Then the Lord raised up judges. Saviors. The Lord was with the judges and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judges. There's a stability, there's a safety. But whenever the judge died, they turned back, they reverted when the judge slept, going after other gods. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. And that was the cycle of the judges. Evil. God hands them over to enemies. They're in desperate distress. They cry out to God. God gives them this deliverer, a judge. He rescues them. There's a time of peace, of stability, of safety, but then the judge dies and things revert. And that is the cycle of the judges. And we saw all of those things in the story of Gideon. That's how our story started. Started with the Midianites, didn't it? The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Midian 7 years. The hand of Midian overpowered Israel. Because of Midian, the people of Israel made for themselves the dens that are in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. The people do the hard work of ploughing the land and sowing the seed. But every harvest time, raiders from Midian ride in and steal the harvest. You can imagine the frustration. You can, if you put yourself into their situation, all their hard work, and there's nothing gained from it. The desperation. How can we survive? How long can we keep going? The people are reduced to hiding in caves. In their suffering, the people cry out to the Lord, and after sending a prophet to rebuke them, God raises up Gideon to be the rescuer and the ruler. But in the end, Gideon dies, and things revert to the same old idolatry. And in fact, Gideon himself sows the seed of the next cycle of idolatry. Now, Gideon is one of seven major stories in the main part of the book, and almost all of those stories repeat the fateful cycle. Six of the seven stories fit perfectly that pattern, that cycle. And then the book closes with two final stories that show just how bad things had become, how lawless the times were. So here's an outline of the book of Judges. I put that up there just so if you were to study it, you could get your mind around it, your arms around it. Starts with that introduction, failure and success, and then the cycle of the judges in chapters 1 to 3. And then you have the middle section, the main part of the book, the seven judges, Othniel. A very short story because he's just typical. It's just a cycle. Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Abimelech, Jephthah, and Samson. Seven stories, seven major judges, and then a sort of epilogue about the lawless times where we read about Micah's idols and New Sodom. And so that's the book. And you can see that the Gideon story is right in the center of that outline. And it's also the longest of the stories there, of the seven main stories. Just slightly longer than Samson. And it's there at the heart. And that's why I chose that one. In a way, it sums up very well the book of Judges. Now, as a whole, the book of Judges teaches us three great lessons. The first is the human tendency to turn away from God. The human tendency to turn away from God. I wonder if you've ever pushed a supermarket trolley which veers to one side. You're pushing the trolley, but there's something wrong with it, something wrong. Or it might be a pushchair and the wheels got caught in a slightly offline way and it's sort of pulling you to one side all the time. Or even, they don't do it now, but sometimes your car was like that. There was some problem with the steering and it was sort of pulling one way. Or it's like talking to a person that wherever you start the conversation, it always ends up back with the same thing. Maybe with some grievance from the past. You know, there's a sort of like a pull into maybe you know someone like that. But ever since the Great Rebellion, human beings have an inbuilt bias against God. We're veering off course. Now, sometimes in history there have been great turnings to God, revivals we call them, but they don't last. And that means that every new generation needs a fresh experience of God. And so that's what the book of Judges tells us, this human tendency to turn away from God. We can't live on the past. What happened to our fathers, the generation before us. Then the second lesson in the book of Judges is God's surprising choice of deliverers. And we're going to come back to that. So I'm not going to linger there. But the third lesson from the book of Judges is that merely human deliverers can't fix the problem. Merely human deliverers can't fix the problem. For one thing, they die. And then everything goes belly up again. And for another thing, they can't change people's hearts. But above all, they're flawed. At very best, the judges in the book of Judges are like medicine, which addresses the symptoms, but then wears off. And often there are some nasty side effects with the medicine. And occasionally the medicine is worse than the condition itself. That's the one story that doesn't fit the pattern is the story of Gideon's son Abimelech, who is 100% the problem. There isn't even an outside attacker. It's just Abimelech is the trouble. He is the problem. Merely human deliverers can't fix the problem. That's the lessons that we learn from the book of Judges. And so the book of Judges is teaching us that what we need is a perfect, undying, heart-changing deliverer to save us and rule us. That's the great thrust of the book. What we need is an undying, perfect, heart-changing deliverer to save us and rule us. And so the book of Judges points us to Jesus. Because that's exactly what we have in Jesus. A deliverer who doesn't die. A deliverer who's not part of the problem, but who's perfect. A deliverer who's able to change hearts, to transform people. So that's the book as a whole. Because we're doing this as a one-off, and I like to set the context. That's just giving you, a very quick overview of the book of Judges. But I want us now to focus on the story of Gideon. And in particular, I want you to see God's surprising choice of rescuer. So that middle lesson from the hat trick of three great lessons in the book, we're going to focus in on God's surprising choice of rescuer. And we can sum it up by saying God prefers to use weak people. God prefers to use weak people. And we see that both in terms of Gideon himself and in terms of Gideon's army. So think about Gideon, first of all. What's the first thing that we're told about Gideon? Chapter 6 and verse 11. Now the angel of the Lord came, sat under the terebinth at Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress to hide it from the Midianites. Maybe you don't know much about threshing wheat or about wine presses. But the idea of threshing wheat is that you've got the wheat and the chaff, and you throw it up in the air, and the chaff is light and it gets blown away and the wheat falls back down, and then you've got the good stuff that you can turn into flour and bake bread. And so in order to thresh wheat, what you need is a nice wide open, out in the open place, so the wind can blow the chaff away, yeah? So that's threshing. And then a wine press is like a hole in the ground. There's an impression, and then there's walls all the way around it, and that's where you crush the grapes. And the point is, the very last place that you would thresh wheat was in a wine press, because it's like an enclosed space rather than an open space. So why is Gideon doing that? Well, he's doing that because he's frightened of the Midianites. He's frightened of being seen. Whether that's prudent or cowardly, the author doesn't tell us. But at the very least, it's cautious. Gideon is cowering with the rest of his people rather than making a brave stand. He's hardly leadership material, we might think. And then in the light of that, verse 12 sounds just a touch sarcastic. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." Didn't look like a mighty man of valor, threshing his wheat in a wine press. And then we have Gideon's commission in verse 14. And the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do I not send you?" And so how does Gideon respond? Yeah! Let's do this. No, he doesn't respond like that at all. In fact, in verse 15, he says, "Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? Behold, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." Rather than being up for it, rather than being ready, as it were, to lead the charge, he's very conscious of his weakness. But God prefers to use weak people. Now, the first thing God does is he asks Gideon to make a stand in his own family. Remember, Gideon's father Joash has this altar to the false god Baal, the idol god. That was the whole problem. They were worshipping Baal, this pagan deity, instead of the Lord. And it's right there in Gideon's family. Gideon's father is a leader in the community, and he has this altar to Baal, and Gideon has to tear it down, and he has to sacrifice the family bull on it, which he does at night, because he's frightened of the town. You say, once again, it might be prudence, but you get the feeling that courage isn't Gideon's strong point. You get the feeling that that's not, in a sense, the first impression that you would get from the man. Not the sort of person you'd expect to lead the charge against marauding invaders. Except that God prefers to use weak people. And after that, we read how the Midianites attacked. God's Holy Spirit comes on Gideon. He blows the trumpet. An army of men start gathering together. And in the end, there are over 30,000 men under Gideon's banner. And you'd think that that would be an encouragement to Gideon. He's seen this great army gather around him, but he's still wobbly. Will God really use him? Will God really save the people? And so we have this business with the fleece. He needs a sign. This theme of needing a sign from God is one of the key themes that runs through the story of Gideon. We won't go into that, but in the end, that was his downfall, the desire for guidance on tap. But in this case, he's genuinely needing some reassurance, and so he puts the fleece out, and God does what he asks. And then he asks for it again. You sort of get the feeling that Gideon almost wants to call the whole thing off. He wants an excuse to walk away from it. But God perseveres with him. In fact, God is very tender with Gideon's wobbles. Gideon knows he's sort of walking on the edge, asking for the second sign, but God gives it. God is gracious. God doesn't mock Gideon, that mighty man, that mighty warrior. There is an irony there, but God doesn't. It's not cruel to Gideon. He reassures Gideon. And in fact, in the next chapter, we see that when Gideon has to go down, he doesn't ask for a sign, but God says, let me give you one. You go down to the camp, you listen, and that will reassure you. God knows Gideon's heart. The point is, though, Gideon is hardly impressive leader material. In fact, he's rather weak, which is just why God chooses to use him. Because God prefers to use weak people. So now think about Gideon's army. Here they are, all 32,000 of them. Now they're still outnumbered, 4-1, but at least they've got a chance, right? That's the problem. You can imagine Gideon looking down the valley, and there are the hordes of Midianite raiders, and he's thinking, there's just too many. And God agrees. But he's talking about Gideon's army. Gideon has got too many. See there in chapter 7 and verse 2, this is at the heart of the Gideon story. The Lord said to Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand. Too many, God says. So God implements some army reducing measures. Verse 3, now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead. Then 22,000 of the people returned and 10,000 remained. Obviously, 2/3 of the army had just seen how many Midianites there were. So here's the deal. Anyone who is fearful and trembling can go home except Gideon. That's been sorted out already, hasn't it? Gideon has to stay. He's not allowed to go with the 22,000. And so here they are. There are only 2,000. There are only 10,000 left. And now they're outnumbered 13-1. But God still isn't satisfied. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Take them down to the water. And so there's this business by the waterside, and some writers, some commentators on the Bible make this big thing about how Gideon must be choosing the most alert troops or something like that. But the main point is he's simply reducing the numbers. He's got to get the numbers down. What's this going to... The problem was too many from God's point of view. They weren't weak enough. And in the end, Gideon's army is reduced to 300. Talk about unimpressive. But God prefers to use weak people. And with that army, God will bring about a great victory. How does he do it? Does he turn them all into supermen so that each one can defeat 100 men, 1,000 men? Nope. All they do is blow their trumpets and break their jars and hold up their torches, and God does the rest by causing the Midianites to turn upon one another in panic. You know, I wonder, when he went down into the camp, one of the men had had a nightmare, hadn't they? I wonder if everyone in the camp had had nightmares. And so when, as it were, all of the blazing lights come out, there's suddenly this panic and they turn upon one another. Now there's plenty more pursuing to do, and the other Israelites are called out, the ones that were sort of sent home, come back now, they've got a job to do, and there's this great victory. But the basic point is that God uses a weak army under a weak leader to achieve his victory, because God prefers to use weak people. And we see this time again in the Bible. When God's plan involved founding a new nation, he chose for the founder an old man with an infertile wife. And that's hardly a strong starting point if you're looking for numbers. And when God rescued his people from Egypt, he uses Moses the old shepherd, not Moses the young prince. And when God's people are threatened by giant Goliath, the champion in the Philistine army, how was he defeated? By a boy with a sling and a stone. Time and again, this is God's way. The leaders in the early church were nothing to look at. They were ordinary, uneducated folks. They were fishermen and the like. So why does God prefer to use weak people? Well, the story of Gideon tells us why. There in chapter 7 and verse 2, the Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" God doesn't want us to take the credit for his saving work. God doesn't want us to think that we have done it, when in reality he has done it. God doesn't want us thinking that the universe revolves around us, when actually it revolves around him. We prefer strength, because that way we think that we can guarantee success. That's why we want to be strong, isn't it? So that we can guarantee success. But the success of God's plans is never in doubt. He doesn't need to be strong to guarantee success, because his plans will always succeed. He is God. Whatever he decides will come to pass. And we tend to be so concerned about what happens, whereas God's great concern is the spiritual effect. If our success leads to pride, if our success leads to self-congratulation, then it will be worse than failing. Far worse, because pride is a far greater danger. Pride is a far more serious problem than failure. So how do these verses apply to us this morning? Well, firstly, we see that God's priorities are seen most clearly in his method of salvation. God chose to save the people there in this way to show his priorities, that he would get the glory and not the Israel. Now all of us, and that is seen in God's great method of salvation, all of us by nature are born at war with God. Our hearts are against God, whether we're formally religious or not. We're born as his enemies. How can we be reconciled to him? How can things be put right between God the Creator and sinful human beings? Now, we might have all sorts of ideas. Do your best. Try harder. This or that religious or meritorious activity or attitude. But to each and every one of those things, God says, too many. If that was how you got right with God, then people would boast. My own hand has saved me. They would say, well, I was just the right sort of person, or I tried really hard, or I did this, or I didn't do that. But instead of that, God's method of saving is utterly humbling. For God to change us and save us, we have to come to him empty-handed. We can't point out that we're better than so-and-so. We can't point out the things that we've done well or that we haven't done badly. We have to come empty-handed. As soon as we try and bring anything, we can't receive anything. We have to come and put our trust in the crucified Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ, dying in our place. All that we bring to the table is our sin. That's all we contribute. Jesus does everything in dealing with it, in taking it away. And no message could be more calculated to give God all the credit and to give us none. You know how it is at the Oscars or other award ceremonies. In their speeches, people come out and they say, I'd just like to thank so-and-so. I'd just like to thank my family, or I'd just like to thank my agent, or I'd just like to thank my support staff. But when it comes to salvation, God doesn't say, I just want to thank so-and-so for preaching so powerfully, or I just want to thank so-and-so for being open-hearted and ready to respond. I just want to thank so-and-so for bringing so much to the table. No, God doesn't need to thank anyone, because it's all his doing. Salvation is set up so that God gets the glory. We get the blessing, but God gets the glory. We're dead in sins. We only come when God breathes spiritual life into our hearts. Even then we come entirely empty-handed with nothing to bring but our sin and nothing to plead but God's mercy and Christ's saving work. Have you understood that this morning? Have you understood that the only way to be right with God is to come with nothing? If your instinct is to talk about you, what you've done, what you haven't done, what's been done to you, if you're in the picture at all, then you're not yet right with God. You have to come, put all of your faith, all of your trust, all of your confidence outside of yourself. You don't even put faith in your faith. I've got strong faith. So I've got a strong Saviour. That's where all of your trust needs to be. Until that is the case, you're not yet right with God. Are you willing to come to God on those terms? Because there are no other terms. And the same is true when God chooses to use Christians to carry out his purposes. In his kindness, God involves us in what he is doing, but never so that we can take the credit. In fact, God would rather we fail than we would be proud. So if you're a Christian, if you're following Jesus this morning, how should you apply these verses? How should we apply these verses to ourselves? Well, we need to accept our personal weaknesses. We should never accept our sin. We should never excuse our sins as weaknesses. Every day we should fight to put sin to death and live in a way that pleases God. Yet even through those things, God keeps us humble. God ensures that he gets all the credit for saving us and keeping us. But when it comes to our genuine weaknesses, we can embrace them. You know, I get so frustrated about my rubbish memory. It really gets me down every week. I see faces, I meet people, and I've met them before, but I don't remember who they are, I don't remember their names, I don't remember their faces. I read books. Someone said, "What? You've read that book, what did you think of it?" Oh, that was last month. I get so frustrated by that. That doesn't matter, God's given me that. Yes, I've got a rubbish memory, or my words get muddled up, or you don't have much physical or emotional strength. Yes, I haven't amounted to much by this world's standards. You can say that. We need to accept our personal weaknesses. Why should that matter to me? It doesn't matter to God. God has made me with my weaknesses, and he's loved me. God has loved me. It's safer to be weak than strong. There's less danger of pride that way. We need to accept our personal weaknesses. Then also, we needn't worry about our weakness as a church. What I mean is our weakness in terms of numbers, in terms of gifts, in terms of influence, our unimpressiveness, humanly speaking. Wouldn't it be great to have hundreds of people? Wouldn't it be great to be sort of all of those hundreds of people bursting with gifts and abilities? All of us movers and shakers in our society. We might think like that, but God doesn't. Because that way we would be sorely tempted to take all of the credit for anything God does. If God can use us in our weakness and in our unimpressiveness, then he gets the glory. It's going to be obvious that it's not Highbury Baptist Church. Everyone realizes that anything we achieve is due to his blessing, not our ability. So we needn't worry about our weakness as a church. But then finally, and of great importance, God's great answer to our weakness is his presence. Go back one last time to the Gideon story, back to chapter 6 and verse 12. The angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." That's why it's not entirely sarcastic. The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor. If the Lord is with you, then he is a mighty man of valor. Verse 14, the Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Do I not send you?" "Please, Lord, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest, I am the least." And the Lord said to him, "But I will be with you. I will be with you." That's God's answer to Gideon's weakness. I will be with you. God's great answer to our weakness is his presence. We sing about weak made strong, and there's a truth in that, but sometimes it's weak staying weak. Weak staying weak, but with Jesus with us, the Lord at work with us. And that was exactly the promise that Jesus gave to his church when he commissioned us to take out the gospel. Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. And behold, I am with you. I'm with you all the days, even to the end of the age. Go and make disciples, and I'll be with you. And that promise still holds good. God's great answer to our weakness is his presence. We started with the question, would you rather be weak or strong? I said it was a no-brainer. It certainly is in the eyes of our world, our society. But what if we extend the question? Would you rather be weak or strong if weakness means the possibility of experiencing the presence and strengthening of Christ? Would you rather be strong or weak plus Jesus? Does that change your answer? It's not a no-brainer anymore, or maybe it is, but the other way. For every true Christian, it will change our answer, even though sometimes we struggle with being weak. Because nothing is more important than having Jesus with you. Nothing is more important than knowing his smile. Amen. Let's close with